This audio number 12 is a collection of topics which came to my mind after I completed the above audio recordings, and I felt it was important to include this. They are not exactly in order chronologically, but I felt they were relevant, and so I've included them and will comment on them as follows. At this time, I'd like to issue a recognition of the members of IEEE who joined with me in 2017. We formed what we called the Concerned Ethics Volunteers, or the CEV. It was a collection of very experienced members in the ethics and professional area. And we worked for several years trying to get restored both ethics advice and ethical support. But to date, this has been unsuccessful. I want to thank each one of those who contributed, starting with our youngest member was Jeanette Barrett, myself, Charles Turner, Ray Larson, Martha Sloan, Steve Unger, and Victor Zoris. Among this group, we had life members, we had fellow members, senior members, several doctor members, a past IEEE president, past chairs of the Ethics Committee, the Member Ethics and the Member Conduct Committee, and various contributors to papers in the ethics field. Wish to thank each one of them very much. In the mid to late 1990s, when I was serving on either the Member Conduct Committee or I was assisting the Ethics Committee operate the IEEE hotline, I was handed a task for investigating and trying to resolve, which came in from a professor in the middle central part of Africa requesting assistance of support where he was having problems with his supervisor. There is no written record of this, so this is from memory, and some of it may be a little bit in error. I corresponded with him by email, and he advised me that he had a situation where he had run up against a conflict with his supervisor in their teaching organization at the university, and he was asking for support. I tried to get as much information as I could from him. It was very sketchy. I corresponded with him several times. He asked some questions. I gave him some advice, answered the questions. And we thought there would be a formal request for ethical support case originate from this. But all of a sudden, he advised me that he withdrew that request, but he gave no specifics as to what was resolved between he and his supervisor. Nevertheless, we can learn some things from this. First of all, here I was in the United States and here he was in Central Africa. We were not talking directly, we were corresponding by email. I had no firsthand knowledge about what their engineering laws were, their employment laws, or their customs, or their norms. So representing IEEE at this stage, it was very difficult for me to really put my arms around what the environment was for conflicts between a subordinate and a supervisor. Quite different from here in the United States, where we have what's called the at-will employment law. It's an outdated one, but still in practice, where an employee can be fired for any reason whatsoever. Now, this is being challenged, and it was a basis of our IEEE pleading in the BART case, where if someone, an engineer or someone, is asked to do something which is unlawful and they refused, they are protected under this public option exception situation. given that situation, this is why I have been recommending that we create multiple member conduct committees and distribute them into the various regions outside, particularly outside the United States, because of this environment. We do not have, in New York, we do not have firsthand knowledge of what their customs laws and norms are, but engineers working in those countries and close to where the problem resides will have that, and they can interpret the situation much better. So in my recommendations for modifying the current Ethics and Member Conduct Committee to separate out into a single Ethics Committee and multiple Member Conduct Committees into the regions, this is the basis of it. And this was learned from this particular preliminary case. Thank you. Now I'm going to discuss an assortment of items which probably should be dispersed among the above 10 or 11 topics, but I'll go ahead and start now. I want to just clarify that when Virginia Egerton approached the IEEE and requested ethical support, she phoned me, and it was just after the Member Conduct Committee had got formed in 1978. Remember that the Member Conduct Committee was formed to provide three services to its members: disciplining members who are alleged to have violated a code of ethics, ethical support when their employment is jeopardized for adhering to the code of ethics, and requesting and being provided ethical advice in various preliminary situations. Well, because I had no hands-on experience yet dealing in matters of ethical support, but I knew that Dr. Stephen Unger, who I had worked close with in forming the Member Conduct Committee, had worked extensively and led basically the IEEE to get involved in the BART case of the three engineers that were terminated in their trying to resolve anticipated safety problems in design of the automated train system between San Francisco and Oakland, California. So what I did, I referred her to Stephen Unger directly. So she contacted him, and he, with the Committee on the Social Implications of Technology, undertook her case, investigated it, wrote a report on ethical support, and then passed it on to the Member Conduct Committee. Now, the Member Conduct Committee never published a report that we could find, but the Committee on the Social Implications under Stephen Unger did. Now, I kept in touch with Virginia in her later years. I found that she had moved to Sweden. She, at that time, had been married, but her husband had passed. She was living in a nursing home because her health had failed, and I was able to correspond with her through her caretaker until she passed away about 2 to 3 years ago. I never met her, though. I classify her as a heroine in the ethics field, probably our first one in IEEE. Now I'm going to offer comments about a matter I had talked about before involving a former IEEE president, Wally Reed. Now, I had referred to IEEE as being a 501c3 nonprofit corporation, but I learned recently that it, under the New York law, it's a 501c6, which has some different restrictions. Now, in Wally's case, he was the one that made the statement in the Member Conduct Committee, and then it got published and still is in the EMCC Ops Manual. The statement made by Wally, and it's printed that way in the Ops Manual, that IEEE shall not get involved in employee-employer conflicts or disputes. That statement of Wally Reed, which is in the Ops Manual, only has merit in regards to involvement in typical union matters involving collective bargaining. It does not apply in the ethics, support, and ethical advice category. It does not apply there whatsoever. My personal and professional opinion. Now, when a director serves in the capacity of a nonprofit such as IEEE, what's their obligation to the corporation and to its members? Their first legal obligation is not to their outside interests, not to their employer, not to their business associates outside. It's to the members. The members. That's who they are to look up to for providing whatever is needed as a corporation. That's their first and most important obligation. Now, if they fail to do that, and it seems to me like over the past 22 years, there's been a constant failure of very succeeding boards to not correct this, of not providing ethical advice and ethical support. That seems to me to be, my personal opinion, a conflict of interest. And it needs to be corrected. It's long overdue, needs to be corrected. Thank you. Next, I want to discuss the IEEE Ethics Hotline that was formed in the middle 1990s by the Ethics Committee. And I served on that hotline. In fact, Steve Unger and I and others were the ones that created it. Well, when it was shut down in 1998, in secret meeting by the board of directors and XCOM, and they excluded Steve Unger, who was the new chair of the Ethics Committee. During that period when it did operate, this was over a couple of years in IEEE, it never experienced any legal problems. There were never any complaints, and certainly the IEEE was not exposed to any liability. And that was the basis they were trying to use to justify shutting it down. Well, once it was shut down, Steve Unger and I contacted Dr. Carolyn Whitback at the Online Ethics Center, told her we had this experience, and we would like to recommend forming the same hotline under their auspices. And that's what we did. And Steve and I and a couple others, we developed the procedures, patterned after what we did in IEEE, and we operated that for at least 2 years, maybe 3 years, successfully. We answered questions, we provided advice, we referred individuals to other services, such like in whistleblowing. And then the Online Ethics Center decided they no longer wanted to run that, so they then transferred it to the National Academy of Engineering. And the National Academy of Engineering, NAE, operated it for a short while until they decided they did not want to continue with it at all. But the history of the original IEEE Ethics Hotline, it was successful then, it was successful under the Online Ethics Center, and it was successful while it operated under the NAE. It needs to be reestablished in IEEE. Here's another issue that we need to address. When a engineer becomes licensed as a professional engineer in their state organization, that's each state has their own jurisdiction. They establish their own state laws governing that. But they all work collectively under the National Professional Engineering Practice based in Clemson, South Carolina, to guide them. They have a model law. Well, in those cases where conflicts occur and support is being needed by the engineers, there should be a second source for supporting one's legal code of professional conduct. Now, here I'm not talking about IEEE's code of conduct. Each PE under their state agrees to practice under a state legal code of professional conduct for engineering. They enforce it. And however, I don't know of any case where the state has got involved in any of these cases where an engineer is requesting support in an industry situation, because the law has, throughout the United States, has basically exempted engineers who practice in industry. But they are still held, if they are a licensed, which I am, I'm retired now, we're still held responsible. Our top priority is the protection of the public, just like the IEEE Code of Ethics say. Well, how can one person do that against a corporation? There needs to be outside mechanisms. And I think if each engineer was licensed and if each state licensing board got up to date on this, they have the basis to provide outside state legal resources to help the engineer in those situations. That would be protecting the public under the law. That's my opinion. Next, I'm going to make reference to the win-win ethics conflict situation which I was involved with, which I discussed previously. I want to comment here that it's important for a supervisor, an engineering supervisor, to be up on the latest practices and customs for when a subordinate approaches them with a situation. In this case, for me, it was a situation where my subordinate senior engineer was given 40 hours to evaluate product A, but given much, much less hours to evaluate product B, which I believe was the preference of our business development person. Well, as his engineering supervisor, I merely realized that if left unadjusted, and if our team was awarded that contract, now, and we're talking about some big dollars, our value, our proposal alone was $1 billion. It was for the Air Force. Well, if vendor B's product had not been selected after our award, it could raise a financial penalty liability for my company. They might want to bring suit because they were treated unfairly. So a lesson here is for supervisors to be sensitive to what their subordinates raise and those kinds of issues, as they may very well be in the company's interest, as they were this time. So they must listen to them carefully and do the right thing, both ethics and business-wise, to avoid liability damages. That would be another win-win. But in my situation, what happened was my second manager, it's the administrative manager, he hires, trains, assigns to projects, and fires. His reaction was hostility. He immediately threatened me that if I didn't resolve this with my program manager, I would be out of a job. That was his first reaction. It wasn't to learn about what the issue was and does it affect the company financially, and it was something that really was in the company's benefit. No, he wanted to take action against me, fire me. Anyways, hopefully these supervisors that are both administrative and program management are much more informed about how to go about doing this. Now I'm going to change the topic a little bit. I failed to cite this earlier about my engineering career, but I served on different bodies, and I want to just cite a few of them. First of all, for a short period of time, I was asked, and I did, serve on the National Institute of Engineering Ethics Board of Directors. I was not able to attend any of their meetings, though. They were located in Lubbock, Texas, at the Texas Tech campus. They are now moving to another location. I can't identify what it is. I don't know. But anyway, it's important to be in a position where you can serve on a board and help in the ethics area. Then I served on a number of industry standards groups. One that's close to IEEE was the original IEEE 802 Local Area Network Standards Committee. That was in the 70s, and we were working on the very first standards for Ethernet standardization, token passing, and there was one other. We had three different approaches. Well, I chaired the network management task group in that effort. And I had some really bright engineers working with me. They were from AT&T, Bell Labs, the U.S. government. So that was one industry standards group. Another, from that, I had been transferred to my avionics division. So I knew they were going to work on developing a new high-speed avionics data bus. So I got involved, and at the very first meeting, I said, well, look, I've been working on the IEEE 802 local area networks, and there's some great work there already done. Let's look at it and see if it can be adapted to this work. Well, that led me to being appointed chair that High-Speed Avionics Data Bus Standards Committee. It was worked under SAE, the Society of Automotive Electronics. And we had the members from the various military services from the UK on that. And the outcome of that today are data buses and new aircraft, tanks, anything that is automotive, instead of being operated by hydraulics, can be now signals can be sent from A to B by electronics over this bus. It had to be survivable, it had to have low latency. It was a very interesting assignment. Then I also served on an ANSI, American National Standards Institute, Public Data Networks Committee. And there they were working on the International Standard X25 for packet switching. The various carriers around the world would implement within their network the packet switching that would allow computers to connect. But this would be the standard that that the computer would use to connect to their network, X25. On that committee, I got interested in what was called datagram packet switching. It was connectionless. Most of the carriers were promoting a connection-oriented interface, and I saw advantages, and others did too, for the connectionless. So I volunteered, and I was appointed to chair the task force group that worked on that part of the standard. And on that committee, I had members from Xerox, carriers, and the U.S. government. In fact, Dr. Vinton Cerf, who is the father of the ARPANET, which led to the Internet, he was a contributor on my task force. I kept in touch with him later, and we would see each other at different meetings and association. And under President Bush, he was awarded the highest civilian award for contributions to the national effort. Many of the international carriers opposed datagram. They didn't want that interface, but non-governmental organizations, computer houses, could see the advantage of that and wanted it. That got a lot of publicity. And then we applied that in my assignment at work at NCR, where I was working on an internal standards group. I brought a lot of that material in, and we were able to adapt to that. Then I served on a National Society of Professional Engineers state organization, and my state was the Florida Engineering Society. They had various practice groups, and the one I was in was the Practice of Engineers and Industry, PEI. And there I was appointed as a state vice president. And at the annual FES meeting, it was in 1975 at Marco Island, I volunteered and I debated against a engineering manager on the topic of whether engineers in industry should be licensed or not. They currently are exempt from that. And I have always taken the position that that's wrong. They should not be exempted. And that was an accommodation that was made because industry in Florida and probably around the United States had enough political clout that they got that done early. And no one has attempted to make a change to that right now. And it's really affected professionalism of employed engineers, left them standing out there all by themselves. But if they were licensed, at least they have the state that they could go to. If IEEE isn't going to support them, hopefully the state would be equipped to be able to provide them legal support. On a previous occasion, which I mentioned above, at a section meeting of IEEE in the Boston section, I was invited and I participated in debating there earlier the same principle. I debated against a engineering manager who happened to be employed with GE. And I took the position where engineers in industry should not be exempt. They should be required to be licensed to protect the public. He took the business and management's position. No, they did not want their engineers working for them to be licensed. They wanted to control everything, and they said they would take responsibility for it. Well, in my advocating my position, I was totally shocked when he, in front of everyone, he accused me of being a communist for taking that viewpoint. I was stunned, but I did not respond to him. I ignored it. Later, I learned that the IEEE had named a prestigious award, I don't remember which one it was, in his honor. Boy, was that a shock. Different topic again. When I was in between employment in 75, and I've talked about this previously, for a short period of time, I accepted a position with NASA, one of their subcontractors, over at the Kennedy Space Center, working on the space shuttle program. And with my background in being a system engineer and working in electronics and communications, I was assigned the task to study and collect and develop the requirements, preliminary requirements, for the audio telephone system to support the space shuttle program primarily at Kennedy Space Center. Well, I left that to go to South Carolina to work for NCR, so I never got to see the completion of it, but some sort of a telephone system was put into use. You can see that in the days of the launch, all the people had to talk to each other. Now I want to give recognition to someone who has had a big influence on my career and my involvement in IEEE. And that is Dr. Stephen H. Unger. At the time, he was a professor in electrical engineering at Columbia University. I first got involved with him around 1973, shortly after the BART case became a hot item, and he led IEEE into getting the amicus curiae legal brief filed in the case on behalf of the three fired engineers. This came about as a result of his leading the Committee on the Social Implications of Technology, a precursor to the SSIT of today. The committee met and they voted and agreed unanimously that IEEE should provide a service of supporting engineers who come in ethical conflict for trying to uphold their first responsibility of protecting the public, and that the IEEE should enter the BART case. That was really led by Steve Unger and his Committee on the Social Implications of Technology. And then I read a lot of the material that he was developing and eventually volunteered and was assigned to work with him and others to develop the requirements for developing the Member Conduct Committee. He led the material being developed for the disciplining service. I led the material for the requirements and the process for providing ethical advice and ethical support. Well, I want to cite Steve in the following manner. I consider him to be, quote, the father of IEEE ethics, unquote. And if there's any way that that recognition could be extended to him, I certainly would support it. Further, I consider Steve had been, through my career in IEEE, in ethics and professionalism, a mentor to me. And I looked up to him and collaborated with him. We've known each other professionally through IEEE since the early 1970s. Now, another item, which I'm going to talk about, it's a sad item. We had a member on the Ethics Committee, Joe Wujek, W-U-J-E-K, I believe it is. He was a professor in California. He was a great co-worker in the ethics field, very active. All the things we did at that time, this was in the mid to late 90s. Very strong ethics proponent. We had some sessions that were held in conjunction with Sections Congress. And he was there and he participated. Well, he and his wife were on a vacation trip driving. And on the way back, they were involved in an accident. And I believe he and his wife were both killed in that car accident. And that was about probably maybe 5 years ago. That was really, really a shame. Anyway, I want to cite Joe. He was a great co-ethics comrade, that's how I put it. And his students really recognize him at his burial services. So I want to thank Joe for what he did for IEEE and for working with us. The last topic I want to talk about, I'm calling the dilemma employed engineers in industry face attempting to practice ethically. Here's a dilemma. On the one hand, because of the IEEE Code of Ethics, and if they were licensed, there's the state code of ethics, legal. They are held to be accountable to protect the public safety as the paramount number one responsibility. And then on the other hand, most of them are employed in industry under the at-will law, which allows them to be fired for any reason whatsoever, including the color of their eyes. Well, that's quite a dilemma. What I'm asking for is, while one's professional society will not provide ethical support, but IEEE, in this case, it touts the tagline of advancing technology for humanity. If one was to hold a PE license provided by the state, why couldn't that provide them access to state legal ethical support? I kind of raised that at this time. Because the question I'm asking, how can a single at-will employed engineer in industry with no written contract be expected to uphold one's professional responsibility, number one, against the power of the employer in a design safety dispute? What protections are there for the employee engineer in these kinds of situations? That's the dilemma, and that's what needs to be addressed by IEEE, by the entire engineering profession, and by the state licensing boards. That's my professional opinion. Thank you. This is the end of audio number 12. Thank you for listening.